and some objects are treated as exempt from the Schrödinger equation. Hence the desperate need to shut up while calculating. There have been physicists who have tried to bring the idea that quantum physics is fundamental into their calculations. To do so, they had to give up Copenhagen's solution to the measurement problem and perform conceptual work to solve the problem a different way. In other words, these people like David Bohm and Hugh Everett, had to develop new interpretations of quantum physics because the Copenhagen interpretation doesn't take quantum physics seriously. It requires that we abandon the idea that quantum physics can be used to deal with everything in the universe and restricts it to a limited domain. Today, most physicists agree with Zeilinger that there is no limit to the validity of quantum physics, but the manner in which quantum physics is generally taught and used betrays that ideal. Nonetheless, the appeal of Copenhagen makes some sense, seen in this light. Quantum physics drove much of the technological and scientific progress of the past 90 years. Nuclear power, modern computers, the internet. Quantum-driven medical imaging changed the face of healthcare. Quantum imaging techniques at smaller scales have revolutionized biology and kicked off the entirely new field of molecular genetics. The list goes on. Make some kind of personal peace with Copenhagen and contribute to this amazing revolution in science, or take quantum physics seriously and come face to face with a problem that even Einstein couldn't solve. Shutting up never looked so good. There's more at play here than a simple pragmatic desire to do physics or a clash between physics and philosophy. Ultimately, this is a story about people. The case of the measurement problem, said David Albert, was something very painful for the physics community. A lot of careers were destroyed. The whole business was a real trauma in the psychological sense of the word for physics. The history of quantum foundations is soaked in personalities. If David Bohm had held more palatable political convictions, if Hugh Everett hadn't hated public speaking, if Einstein had had Bohr's charisma, the story told in this book likely would have been dramatically different. So many of the key events were driven by political or social or interpersonal interactions, not by scientific considerations. This suggests another reason the Copenhagen interpretation is so popular. Not because it is somehow better or more suited to the needs of physicists, but simply because it was first. From a naive perspective about science, from the view that science is merely a mechanism for deducing the one true answer from the available clues, like a Sherlock Holmes story, this idea is disturbing. Indeed, this whole book is probably disturbing to someone with such a view. If these extraneous factors could have such a profound influence on fundamental physics, what part of science could possibly remain untouched? And indeed, this isn't limited to quantum foundations. All of science is vulnerable to human biases and to influences from all the other spheres of human endeavor, politics, history, culture, economics, art, that some of those biases spring from. Most scientists, by and large, will agree to this. But agreeing with the abstract existence of these non-scientific biases within science is different from being faced with a concrete example. The idea that something as pervasive and central as the Copenhagen interpretation might be dominant for accidental non-scientific reasons can be scary, especially for people who have devoted their entire lives to physics. Once you give up Copenhagen, there's more than one option on the table. And if there's more than one option on the table, then how do you decide? Asks Dorian Fraser, a philosopher of physics at the University of Waterloo. Is it because you have certain prejudices about what's interesting and what's not interesting? Actually, that's a large part of it, but that's kind of uncomfortable. This discomfort, this fear, is yet another reason why it's tempting, as a physicist, to shut up and calculate. But giving in to that fear just makes it harder for us to see our biases. These biases include a lot of the factors we've seen directly at play in this book. Political considerations, funding models, the milieu of ideas in particular places and times, even simple interpersonal disputes. There are also many biases that have been at work throughout this book, but not in the foreground. A woman, Greta Hermann, found the problem with von Neumann's proof 30 years before Bell did, but nobody noticed at the time. It's hard to imagine that her gender had nothing to do with the reception of her work in 1935, a time when women were still generally not allowed to teach at universities. And given that specialization in the foundations of quantum physics was a professional strike against any physicist, it's also not far-fetched to imagine that few women and non-white physicists would be attracted to work in that area, since their identities were already a strike against them within science and academia as a whole because of systemic bias. This would explain the otherwise remarkable fact that hardly any women, or people who aren't white, appear anywhere in this story at all. Prejudices against certain kinds of people as well as certain kinds of ideas are pervasive throughout science. But the mere existence of these biases doesn't mean that science is identical to all those other spheres of human endeavor, or that scientific truth isn't different from ill-informed opinions with no connection to experiment or reality. Our biases don't fully determine the content of our best scientific theories. Reality pushes back, and we want it to push back as hard as we can allow it. That pushback constrains the possible hypotheses we entertain as scientists. There's a wide middle ground between science is pure and perfectly rational and science is just some bullshit somebody made up. There's still plenty of room for humans to interfere in that middle ground, as we've seen throughout this book. But that doesn't mean science isn't to be trusted. That's as naive as the Sherlock Holmes view of science. That being said, the story of quantum foundations does seem to call into question how science works. We've seen how it doesn't work. It's not about verification or purely empirical statements, as the positivists thought. It's not about falsifiability, as Popper thought. Nor is it about being completely independent from the complex historical forces that have buffeted and buoyed the characters we've met over the course of this book. So how does science work? Echoing the end of Chapter 11, that's a fabulously complex question. The long answer would take another book, but the short answer is that science involves a combination of experiment, mathematical and logical reasoning, unifying explanations, and biases that scientists bring to the table from their own lives and the cultures they live in. We work to reduce those biases. We don't always succeed, but the explicit attempt to account for and reduce those biases is an important part of the process, properly conducted. The whole edifice of science is geared toward this goal, and given the phenomenal explanatory power and predictive success of science, it would be foolish in the extreme to give scientific truths no more credence than idle speculation, religious articles of faith, or deeply held cultural values. Science, done right, works hard to respect absolutely no authority at all other than experience and empirical data. It never succeeds entirely, but it comes closer and has a better track record than any other method we apes have found for learning about the world around us, a world we never made. The story of the search to understand quantum physics is an emphatically scientific one. Yet the cultural and historical forces at work over the course of this book, while par for the course, are still troubling. How can we distinguish a controversy like the one over quantum foundations, a legitimate scientific controversy if ever there was one, from a manufactured pseudo-controversy about science, like the debates over evolution, global warming, and homeopathy? It might seem tempting to compare them. After all, from the perspective of someone who believes, erroneously, that climate change isn't real, evolution didn't happen, and homeopathy works, these are all stories of an overwhelming scientific consensus fought by a scrappy minority of independent thinkers dedicated to the truth at all costs. Yet even that apparent similarity is an illusion. The debates about evolution, global warming, and homeopathy have been explicitly manufactured and funded by a variety of corporate, religious, and political entities from outside science, who are not in the least interested in the quest to divorce our human biases from our understanding of the world. They are not committed to taking the science seriously, and are instead devoted to taking their own aims and giving them a thin patina of scientific respectability, enough to justify their claims to equal or greater validity than the existing and overwhelming scientific consensus. These groups are not interested in examining the data, and happily reject it when it does not meet their preordained conclusions, inventing new data to suit their purposes. In the cases of global warming and evolution, these controversies were invented to push back against a perceived political agenda on the part of science and scientists, and the forces behind intelligent design and climate change denial were not wrong about that. Science is political, and always has been, in that it informs decisions about the best policies in the public sphere as well it should. And science certainly is a threat to the institutions pushing these anti-science agendas. Science will always be a political threat to some institutions, simply by virtue of its attempts to respect no authority other than data and logic. So much the worse for those institutions. And that's another sign that these debates are not like the debate over quantum foundations, because those working against the scientific consensus are allied with, and often funded by, groups that are simply against the idea of science itself, like some fundamentalist religious groups. By contrast, in the debate over quantum foundations, everyone agrees that science works. Otherwise, there wouldn't be much to debate. Despite the deep and sometimes bitter conflict over the Copenhagen interpretation, none of the physicists mentioned in this book doubted that quantum physics was correct, or at least an excellent approximation of some underlying theory. Nobody doubted the veracity of the experimental data that originally inspired quantum physics, nor the data that further supported its predictions once the theory was developed by Heisenberg and Schrödinger and the rest. Nor was there a concerted, organized effort to maintain Copenhagen's dominance. There was no conspiracy or any corporate or political interests at stake in this debate. Just a dispute among physicists about the meaning of a theory that they all agreed was correct. Indeed, the debate over quantum foundations is, at its heart, a debate over just how seriously one should take quantum physics. And the dissenters from Copenhagen were the ones arguing that quantum physics should be taken very seriously indeed, as a theory of the entire world. But there is one way in which quantum foundations does come into contact with the public debates between science and pseudoscience. The Copenhagen interpretation, with its vagueness, its seeming promise of a fundamental role for human consciousness, and its bevy of internal contradictions, has turned quantum physics into a wellspring of purported scientific support, feeding a constant river of New Age nonsense and junk pseudoscience. The TV show Futurama skewered this fairly accurately, showing a physics professor in the year 3008 claiming that, as Deepak Chopra taught us, quantum physics means anything can happen at any time for no reason. Chopra does in fact claim that consciousness arises from quantum entanglement and that quantum healing allows the mind to heal the body through sheer willpower. Our bodies ultimately are fields of information, intelligence, and energy, he said. Quantum healing involves a shift in the fields of energy information so as to bring about a correction in an idea that has gone wrong. Chopra is hardly alone in his spurious assertions about the fabulous implications of quantum physics for medicine. There are endless quantum healthcare scams claiming that their products can channel your thoughts to restructure your body on a quantum level, whatever that might mean. And perhaps most odiously, bestsellers like The Secret have made fantastical claims about the power of quantum physics and have been so successful that they have inspired knockoff books like Why Quantum Physicists Cannot Fail and Why Quantum Physicists Don't Get Fat. I can attest from personal experience that both of these claims are false. These books breathlessly inform you that you can simply achieve what you want by wishing hard enough, reshaping your own reality, since quantum physics proves there is a fundamental role for conscious observers in creating the universe around us. There is a massive irony here. Critics of non-Copenhagen interpretations of quantum physics often say that concerns about Copenhagen come from a desire to keep the world sensible and normal as it was in classical physics. Yet the Copenhagen interpretation harks back to a far older and more comfortable vision of the world than any proposed in any of the other interpretations. Copenhagen puts humans, indeed the self, at the very center of the universe, more important than anything else, just as the ancients had it, with everything else revolving around us. This is why quantum physics holds such appeal in alternative circles. Rather than giving a humbling and strange vision of the universe, the Copenhagen interpretation makes physics familiar and comfortable. If we are to have any hope of understanding the universe, we must dare to imagine a world that is not bounded by our limited perspective. But why does any of this matter? If shutting up and calculating works, and it does, then why do physicists need anything else? And why should any of this matter to anyone who isn't a physicist? It's certainly true that we'll get the same answers when doing quantum mechanical calculations, whether we prefer the Copenhagen interpretation, the many worlds interpretation, the pilot wave interpretation, or anything else. Even alternatives to quantum physics, like spontaneous collapse theories, will give the same answers in nearly every situation. Some people have argued, as Wolfgang Pauli did to Bohm, that because the different interpretations don't make new predictions, we should just stick with Copenhagen. A silly argument, since you could say we should just stick with many worlds or any other interpretation with that same reasoning. Others claim that the alternatives to Copenhagen are driven by a desire to make things less weird than Copenhagen makes them out to be, and we should instead embrace the weirdness, that any discomfort with the Copenhagen interpretation is merely a sign of our limited human ability to understand the world of the quantum. This argument would carry more weight if there were no viable alternatives to the Copenhagen interpretation, if its conclusions were forced upon us. But there's another problem with it as well. All of the proposals we have for solving the measurement problem are weird in one way or another, said David Alpert. Bell's theorem proves they have to be weird, but there's a huge difference between being weird and being incoherent or unintelligible. And, Alpert added, many physicists still do not seem to appreciate this point. Physicists will say, yes, the Copenhagen interpretation is weird, but so is everything else. And you sort of want to slap them and say, no, the Copenhagen interpretation is not weird, it's gibberish, it's unintelligible. And some physicists argue, like good positivists, that because no experiment can tell the difference between the different interpretations, it's meaningless to draw any distinctions between them. That even if Copenhagen is inconsistent, it doesn't matter which, if any, alternative to it we adopt. And this is simply not true. If we want to go beyond our current theories to devise a new theory, to find new physics and explain new experimental results, our interpretations matter. Ask two physicists, a pilot wave theorist and a many worlds theorist, what kind of theory they expect to see going beyond quantum physics, and you'll get two very different answers. Richard Feynman pointed out that although there's no experimental way to tell the difference between two mathematically equivalent theories, that is to say, two different interpretations of the same math, subscribing to one theory or the other makes a huge difference in how you think about the world. That difference, in turn, affects the new ideas and new theories we develop. For example, the 16th century astronomer Tycho Brahe had a theory in which the Earth was at the center of the universe. The Sun and Moon orbited the Earth, and the rest of the planets orbited the Sun. His theory was mathematically equivalent to the heliocentric model of Copernicus. It gave identical predictions about the movement of lights in the sky. But the idea that the Earth wasn't at the center of the universe led to an entirely different set of ideas about how the universe works. Similarly, we could develop an interpretation of quantum physics in which wave functions are powered by invisible unicorns, which obey aggregate laws of herding and flocking that lead to the Schrödinger equation. But, I hope, we can agree that this is a bad idea, significantly worse than any other interpretation. Experimental results are not the only things that enter into the formulation and evaluation of scientific theories, nor could they be. The full content of our theories, not only the mathematics, but the claims about the nature of the world that come along with the mathematics, is important to the work of science. And the worldviews we get from our best scientific theories also make their way to the public and inform how we see ourselves, as I argued in the introduction. This has already happened with the Copenhagen interpretation. That is, after all, where that quantum healing nonsense is coming from, though, to be sure, Chopra and his ilk would probably find some other way to package their work if the Copenhagen interpretation didn't exist. And other interpretations would probably be misunderstood in some ways. Misappropriations of science are inevitable. It's just that Copenhagen seems particularly ripe for it. In the past, new physics has opened up new horizons for human imagination, new ways of thinking about our own existence, new ideas in fields as wildly disparate as biology and art, geology and religion. If Copernicus hadn't unseated the Earth from its place at the center of the cosmos, it's hard to imagine that Darwin could have had the audacity to suggest that humans were not wholly unique creations, but instead descended from apes. And without both of those insights, Kubrick certainly couldn't have filmed 2001. Science and culture form an undivided whole, now more than ever, in our world whose every corner has been reshaped by human activity. If the past is any guide at all, finding the answer to the puzzle of quantum physics and finding the next theory beyond it will ultimately affect the daily lives of every human being, not just the professional lives of physicists. The deep problems at the boundaries of physics, quantum gravity chief among them, have not yielded solutions for decades. These challenges are so profound that a handful of physicists have turned to quantum foundations for guidance and inspiration. Some have suggested that the structure of space-time itself is built out of quantum entanglement, bridging far distant points with wormholes. Others have argued that the multiverses of eternal inflation and string theory are actually the same as the multiverse of the many worlds interpretation, that all three theories are merely different ways of arriving at the same fundamental truth about the cosmos. There's also work that explicitly takes quantum non-locality as a starting point and tries to cook up a theory of quantum gravity that actually breaks Einstein's relativity, since nobody's had unequivocal success in building a theory of quantum gravity that doesn't break relativity. And we've hardly done justice to the profusion of ways to interpret quantum physics that haven't been proposed to date. While the different possibilities laid out in this book are the most significant historically, and they are all mostly still around in various forms, minus Wigner's consciousness-based proposal, which has been dismissed as needlessly speculative and vague, and in danger of collapsing into solipsism, many, many more have been proposed in the past 30 years. There are retrocausal interpretations, which suggest that subatomic particles can affect their own pasts, taking quantum non-locality to an extreme. There are interpretations that try to get around Bell's theorem by altering the axioms of probability itself, though it's not clear if they can succeed. T'Hoft is developing his own interpretation of quantum theory that takes an unusual avenue through the obstacle course of weirdness set up by Bell's results. His theory is superdeterministic, a local, hidden variables theory that has deep prearrangements between subatomic particles and experimental setups. Many physicists and philosophers reject this kind of approach out of hand as a sort of cosmological conspiracy theory that would preclude the very possibility of doing science. Yet T'Hoft believes that he can find a way to do this without sacrificing science itself, and he may not be wrong. Roger Penrose, one of the foremost mathematical physicists alive, believes that wave function collapse is real and that the Schrödinger equation must be modified, as in spontaneous collapse theories. But rather than collapse being entirely random, he believes that it is caused by gravity, marrying general relativity and quantum physics in an unexpected and novel fashion. There are even interpretations that are a kind of hybrid of existing interpretations, like the many interacting worlds interpretation, which has features of both the pilot wave and many worlds interpretations. There are also challenging issues in the interpretation of quantum field theory, the theory that combines quantum mechanics with special relativity and describes the intricate, high-energy physics seen at particle accelerators. QFT shares some of the problems of regular quantum theory. The management problem and non-locality problem are still there. But it also has some new and strange foundational problems of its own. Getting some of the existing interpretations of quantum theory to work with QFT, such as the pilot wave interpretation, is an ongoing challenge. Others, such as many worlds, have no problem with QFT, which is arguably a mark in their favor. And there are so, so many other ideas and open problems in quantum foundations, all fascinating. Despite decades of discouragement and indifference from the rest of physics, the field of quantum foundations is healthy and burgeoning. John Bell, were he alive, would be astonished by what he has wrought. So, what is real? Pilot waves? Many worlds? Spontaneous collapse? Which interpretation of quantum physics is the right one? I don't know. Every interpretation has its critics, though the proponents of basically every non-Copenhagen interpretation are usually agreed that Copenhagen is the worst of the lot. Somehow, something is going on in the world that is related to the mathematics of quantum physics. There is a correct interpretation, though it may not be any of the ones that we have yet. Simply dismissing the quantum world as a convenient mathematical fiction means we aren't taking our best theories of the world seriously enough, and we are hobbling ourselves in the search for a new theory. Stating that the conclusions of the Copenhagen interpretation are inevitable or forced upon us by the mathematics of the theory is simply wrong. It is not true that it's meaningless to talk about reality existing independently of our perceptions, that we must think of the world solely as the subject of our observations. Solipsism and idealism are not the messages of quantum physics. Instead, we physicists should learn the different interpretations available and keep them all in mind while working. Hold on to them loosely, not dogmatically, and keep a fresh perspective on the work we do. I'm not saying that interpretations of quantum physics are something that every physicist should work on any more than every physicist should be working on any other specific open problem in physics, like quantum gravity or high-temperature superconductivity, an unexpected mystery worthy of its own book. But all physicists should be aware of the problem and passingly familiar with the field. We have a wildly successful theory, an embarrassment of interpretations, and a major challenge in moving past our theory to the next one. Pluralism about interpretations might be the right answer, pragmatically, while we face that challenge. Or if not pluralism, at least humility. Quantum physics is at least approximately correct. There is something real out in the world that somehow resembles the quantum. We just don't know what that means yet, and it's the job of physics to find out. This is the great enterprise. This is what everyone in this sprawling tale fought for in their ways. Bell with his scathing critic's pen, Bohm with his stubborn disregard for the status quo, Everett with his prankster style. But their ideas aren't all that matters. Their stories matter too. The history behind the physics can guide us in our pursuits just as a new interpretation of a theory does. The path that led us here can give hints about the way forward. Demonstrating this, if nothing else, has been the aim of this book. I'll give the last word on the subject to someone far more qualified. So many people today, and even professional scientists, seem to me like somebody who has seen thousands of trees, but has never seen a forest. A knowledge of the historic and philosophical background gives that kind of independence from prejudices of his generation from which most scientists are suffering. This independence, created by philosophical insight, is, in my opinion, the mark of distinction between a mere artisan or specialist and a real seeker after truth. Albert Einstein. Appendix. Four views of the strangest experiment. In 1978, not long after moving to the University of Texas, John Wheeler proposed a thought experiment that, according to him, gets at the core of what fueled the Bohr-Einstein debate. In fact, he suggested that this experiment may have something to tell us about the very machinery of the universe. He called it the delayed choice experiment. See figure A1. The experiment has two configurations. We'll start with the simpler one. On the left, figure A1A, a laser beam, that is to say a beam of photons, enters from the lower left-hand corner and enters a beam splitter, which, as the name suggests, splits the beam into two equal parts. One gets bounced up and one passes straight through to the right. The two beams each hit one more mirror, setting them on a course to cross paths again. Each beam hits a photon detector. And that's it. Now consider the same experiment, but with a twist. Figure A1B on the right. At the point where the two beams cross in the upper right-hand corner before they hit the detectors, place a second beam splitter. Each of our two beams splits again. Now, half of each beam goes off to the right toward detector 2, and half of each beam goes up to detector 1. But the beam splitter is constructed in a funny way, so the two combined half beams don't behave the same way in both directions. The two half beams going up are in sync. Their peaks and valleys line up with each other, reinforcing their combined wave. This is constructive interference, like the bright bands in the double slit experiment in chapter 5. But the two half beams going off to the right are perfectly out of sync. The peaks of one line up with the valleys of the other, so they totally cancel out. This is destructive interference, like the dark bands in the double slit experiment. The upshot is that no light reaches detector 2 at all, because the two beams heading toward it destructively interfere with each other, and the light reaching detector 1 is just as bright as the original laser beam that entered the first beam splitter in the lower left-hand corner of the experiment. So far, so good. Aside from the existence of the laser in the first place, everything we've described so far is just classical physics. Now, let's get quantum. Make the laser beam really dim. As dim as possible, in fact, so we're just sending one photon at a time through this experiment. If we don't have the second beam splitter in the upper right-hand corner, this is still pretty simple. The photon is detected at either detector 1 or detector 2, and we can tell which path the photon took through the setup by seeing which detector is arrived at. And if we send lots of photons through, one at a time, about half will show up at each detector. But, Wheeler says, things become much more complicated when we put the second beam splitter back into the experiment. If we do that, a photon will never arrive at detector 2 because it will interfere with itself, just as in the double-slit experiment. Send as many photons as you like through the experiment, one at a time, and they'll all show up at detector 1. This, Wheeler says, is because each photon took both paths and interfered with itself, preventing it from arriving at detector 2. By inserting the second beam splitter, says Wheeler, we make the whole idea of following a single path meaningless. This is not terribly different from the double-slit experiment. Indeed, this is the double-slit experiment, just with a slightly different geometry. And as with the double-slit experiment, it's tempting to say that the photon can tell whether the second beam splitter is there before it starts on its journey through the experiment. If there's only one beam splitter, the photon travels down only one path. But if the second beam splitter is in place, the photon travels down both paths, so it can interfere with itself. But Wheeler introduced one more twist into this experiment, the delayed choice. There's some distance between the beam splitter and the mirror on the lower right-hand side, figure A1A. Let's make that distance big, several kilometers, say. In that case, it'll take the photon, traveling at the speed of light, about a dozen microseconds to get from the beam splitter to the detectors. That gives us plenty of time to direct a computer to insert, or remove, the second beam splitter after the photon leaves the first beam splitter. In other words, we can delay the choice of which experiment we want to do, figure A1A or figure A1B, until after the photon is already on its way through the experiment. Yet if we do this, our results are no different. When the second beam splitter is in place, the photon will never arrive at detector 2, and when the second beam splitter is removed, the photon will arrive at each detector about half the time. These results are quite strange, yet they have been confirmed by actual experiments. Clearly, this happens. But how can the photon decide whether to travel down just one path after it's already passed through the first beam splitter? We can make the apparent paradox even worse by increasing the distance the photon travels. In principle, there's no reason this experiment can't be done using a setup a light year long, or even billions of light years. It's as if a photon can edit its own past in addition to being in two places at once. Or as if our own choices about our experimental setup can change the distant past. And indeed, Wheeler endorsed this view, saying that we must conclude that our very act of measurement not only revealed the nature of the photon's history on its way to us, but in some sense determined that history. The past history of the universe has no more validity than is assigned by the measurements we make now. But this is just one view of this experiment, using Wheeler's version of the Copenhagen interpretation. What, after all, is a measurement, and how does it work? Wheeler never explains this other than to insist that it has nothing to do with consciousness or life. Beyond that, he merely states that a measurement is an irreversible act in which uncertainty collapses to certainty. Measurement. Collapse. We're in familiar territory here, and Wheeler is in the usual trouble of needing to define what measurement is and how it happens, yet refusing to do exactly that. Wheeler also states that the essence of quantum physics, as the delayed choice experiment shows, is measurement. But this is not particularly helpful for determining what actually constitutes a measurement. There are, of course, other ways to look at this experiment, ways that are significantly different from Wheeler's ill-defined and questionably coherent ideas. Here are three of them. Pilot wave interpretation. A photon enters the beam splitter. Its pilot wave splits and travels down both paths, while the photon takes only one path, though we don't know which. If the second beam splitter isn't in place, the pilot wave reaches both detectors, carrying the particle along with it to one or the other. If the second beam splitter is in place, the pilot wave interferes with itself when it arrives there and never reaches detector 2. This prevents the photon from reaching detector 2 as well, no matter which path it traveled down. It doesn't matter whether the second beam splitter is put in place before or after the photon goes through the first beam splitter. All that matters is whether the second beam splitter is there when the pilot wave arrives. Many worlds interpretation. A photon wave function enters the first beam splitter, splits, and travels down both paths. If the second beam splitter isn't in place, the photon wave function hits both of the detectors and entangles with the detector's wave functions. Due to the enormous number of particles involved in this giant entangled wave function, decoherence occurs rapidly and the wave function branches. In one branch, the photon arrived at detector 1. In the other, it arrived at detector 2. If the second beam splitter is in place, the photon wave function interferes with itself destructively when it gets there, ensuring that it never reaches detector 2. Thus, the photon hits only detector 1, and the world does not branch. It doesn't matter whether the second beam splitter is put in place before or after the photon goes through the first beam splitter. All that matters is whether the second beam splitter is there when the wave function arrives. Spontaneous collapse theory. A photon wave function enters the first beam splitter, splits, and travels down both paths. If the second beam splitter isn't in place, the photon wave function hits both of the detectors and entangles with the detector's wave functions. The enormous number of particles involved in this giant entangled wave function all but ensures that one of them will hit the collapse jackpot almost immediately, forcing the photon into one detector or the other entirely at random. If the second beam splitter is in place, the photon wave function interferes with itself destructively when it gets there, ensuring that it never reaches the right-hand detector. It doesn't matter whether the second beam splitter is put in place before or after the photon goes through the first beam splitter. All that matters is whether the second beam splitter is there when the wave function arrives. In short, Wheeler's conclusions are, at best, not forced upon us. At worst, they are logically incoherent. Nor is this experiment particularly odd, seen from these other viewpoints. Certainly not as strange as the Bell experiments. There are versions of this experiment that combine it with aspects of the Bell experiments, but those are similarly possible to explain in all of these interpretations, though the explanations do get quite a bit more complex. One final note. Although pilot waves are in general non-local, in this case, everything is entirely local using the pilot wave interpretation. So there's a sense in which Wheeler was right. This is exactly the kind of thing that was at the heart of the Einstein-Bohr debates, because it can, in theory, be explained locally. Yet adherents of Copenhagen insist on giving a non-local explanation for it. This concludes the reading of What is Real? The Unfinished Quest for the Meaning of Quantum Physics by Adam Becker. Copyright 2018 by Adam Becker. This book was read by Greg Tremblay. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Basic Books, an imprint of Perseus Books, LLC, a subsidiary of Hachette Book Group, Incorporated, New York, New York, USA. All rights reserved, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.